You're listening to First Chapters, a podcast from Grey Cat Books, with your hosts, Engineer Mike and Nina McNamara. Ever wanted to know if the first few pages of a book were good enough to continue reading? Will a book be engaging enough, or will it bore you to death? Then keep listening. The plot thickens.
I was not encouraged to read as a child.
No.
Nobody said, hey, here's a great book.
Football books.
You should read this. No, not even the football books. The most common type of book read was football books.
That absolutely blows my mind. I had no idea that football books were a thing until you brought that
football
up.
Football fiction. Think of like...
Where Joe Montana...
Like, yeah, Joe Montana, not Joe Montana.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking of...
Scarface, yes.
Sorry.
Joe Montana.
Yeah,
Montana.
Would like come to your school and help you kick the...
Yeah, the ghosts. It was usually ghost stories involving
But he's not dead.
No, Nina. He was helping fight the ghosts. He was a Ghostbuster.
This
Joe
is,
Montana.
Okay, this is blowing my mind.
In the world
okay.
of football fiction, there were kids fighting ghosts because that's what always kids are bothered by. Various ghosts of sorts.
Okay, and this is in the South.
It was like a cowboy ghost in this one story. So it was probably in Texas.
Okay, because I was
wondering. Which is kind of the South.
Like, are ghosts represent?
They were not slave ghosts. I don't know what. Where are you going with this? No.
I'm trying to think of why Southerners would read these books and like.
Why Southerners read these books is because they were about a subject matter which was acceptable for a young boy to read and not called some various slur or not.
There you go.
The one football book I remember as a child that I didn't read, but I like saw somebody reading.
Mm-hmm.
It had Emmett Smith. Emmett Smith kind of like appeared at the end. They're like, hey, I'm Emmett Smith. I'm here too. And then he tackled the ghost.
How can you tackle a ghost?
Because they have a corporeal form when they manifest in our astral plane. Come on, Nina. This is very common knowledge.
Okay, well, my knowledge of ghosts...
Am I have to pick a ghost book next?
Please don't. I'm thinking of Ghostbusters.
Yes.
And like, if you tackle a ghost, aren't you covered in ectoplasm?
Yeah, but you still tackle them. You disperse their corporeal form for a little bit.
And like, I'm starting to think about like...
Ectoplasm?
Like, yeah.
You're thinking about the blowjob scene, aren't you?
No, I was not.
I can't mention that lingerie exists, but you're clearly like thinking of Dan Aykroyd
and
a ghost taking
his pants
off.
I was thinking of the Marshmallow Man at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also thinking of Ecto Cooler. I was not thinking of
Ecto Cooler.
I was not thinking of the blowjob scene.
I don't know if I ever drank any Ecto Cooler.
I did.
What
it was just, was it just, it was green.
Green orange juice?
Yeah, it just tasted like...
green sugar juice.
Yeah.
Green sugar juice for kids.
It was
kids
just green sugar juice.
Shut them up.
Yes.
Here, have this fucking thing.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, it was just a little box of high C with Slimer on it, and it was... Just sugar.
Yep, just sugar.
Sugar water.
Sugar and water with a little bit of flavor.
To ruin your teeth.
Yep, to ruin your teeth and to support the dentist industry.
Pretty much.
Yep.
Yeah, it's all a shill. It's all connected, man. So, Engineer Mike, what are you reading this week?
Alrighty. This week I'm reading a book. It's actually an omnibus of two books called Cities of the Air.
Cities of the Air.
By a writer named Carl Schrader.
Mm-hmm.
I was having a discussion on Mastodon with my good friend, Hugo Award-winning author, Charles Strauss.
Oh,
and we started talking about Larry Niven. And I mentioned the favorite Larry Niven novel that I love, like a lesser known work of his called The Integral Trees. One of my favorite books because the setting of The Integral Trees is one of the most unique settings in a book I've ever read in my life. It's basically a formless world of no land where everybody just kind of floats free in a void of air. And I get in it with Charlie and he's like, that book is crap. I mean, I'm telling you, it nearly ended our friendship right there.
God.
Nearly ended our friendship right there. I was like, Hugo Award-winning author Charles Strauss, I don't know if we could be friends anymore. And he was like, hey, I'll fix this for you. I got a writer I know, good friend of his, Carl Schrader, who wrote a book called Cities of the Air. And he's like, hey, go check this book out. And I was like, okay, Hugo Award-winning author Charles Strauss, I'll check
Jesus
it out
Christ.
Just for you this one time. Okay, so I check out the book. Pretty good. Kind of started off a little bit slow, but I'm kind of enjoying it right now. Very similar setting to Larry Niven's The Integral Trees, with some slight differences. I won't get into it here because it involves things like gravity and stuff, which is extremely boring to talk about. But yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. Exactly what I kind of was looking for. And you know what? Hugo Award-winning author Charles Strauss. He knows
just
his books.
Blow
he
each
knows,
other already.
I'm glad he could smooth over our friendship. I probably never would have mentioned his name on this podcast ever again, the way he insulted Larry Niven's work, The Integral Cheese. He called it, I can't remember what exactly he called it. He may have said it was an interesting setting, but otherwise pulp trash.
I'm going to have to agree with your boyfriend there. I tried to read The Integral Trees,
yep.
And I didn't get very far because of that exact reason.
Yep.
I thought it was trash.
The writing wasn't that great?
Correct.
Yeah.
No offense, again, to Larry Niven.
I'll say, whether or not I like this book, possibly a friendship hinges upon it. I'll have to have an update. All right, so Nina, what are you reading?
All right, well, at the risk of turning into you, I'm reading several books.
Oh, hey.
And I it's a little overwhelming, so I'm only going to talk about one that I'm reading right now, and I'll save the other one for another podcast.
Sure.
I am listening to an audiobook that I absolutely adore.
Oh, hey, good.
It's called Disney War by James B. Stewart.
Very cool.
This book, I saw it on Lindsay Ellis's desk. Lindsay Ellis, the YouTuber, former YouTuber, she's now on Nebula. Anytime she talked about anything Disney related, she would have this on her desk and you cite from it.
Mm-hmm.
But this book is about, it's an expose about Michael Eisner, the former CEO of Disney from 1984 to 2004. I think he had a 20-year run.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an expose about his time running the Walt Disney Corporation. And it deals with things like pretty much all of his bad business decisions.
Yeah.
Or what he struggled, or what could have happened had he gotten his way. Like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit almost didn't get made.
One of the best things they created during that time, this guy nearly killed.
Yeah.
Great businessman.
Yeah. And, like, one of the things that you realize early on in the book, and it's nonfiction, early on in the book is that Michael Eisner fundamentally did not understand Disney. He did not grow up with Disney movies. Now, he's an older guy, but Disney has been around for 90 years now, so there were Disney movies when he was a child. He didn't grow up watching them. You and I weren't really Disney kids. We saw Disney movies growing up, but we were not obsessed with them.
No.
But he did not see any Disney movies. He was not familiar with, like, Bambi or Snow White or Cinderella, like those movies that would have been relevant for him when he was a child.
Yeah.
And so when he took over, he was the president of Paramount, I think it was, but he made that company flourish.
Yeah.
So when he took over in 1984 for Disney, I think it was Roy Disney, you know, who was the nephew of Walt Disney, asked him, hey, what are some Disney movies that you grew up watching? And he threw out a couple like that, Snow White and et cetera, all the classics. And Eisner goes, never saw any. He did not quite understand what gave Disney its magic. You know, as as much as I criticize Disney, because I don't feel the same affection for Disney as a lot of, you know, people our age.
Yeah, like we've never even been to Disney World, either one of us.
No, and I have no interest in going. I don't feel that magic. I don't feel that connection, but I can't deny that it exists. And I would be a terrible person, even if I was a successful business person, I would be a terrible person to be the CEO of the Walt Disney Corporation.
I will never understand how businesses choose CEOs, because this is Michael Eisner. You're talking about mid-80s to early 2000s. He oversaw one of the worst time in Disney's history.
The best, but also the worst. So it was the best for animation.
Yeah.
Because in this time, you've got The Little Mermaid, you got Beauty and the Beast, you got Aladdin, you got The Lion King, but also the worst for its live action.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you compare it to, you know, the Disney we know today, this huge juggernaut of a company that owns massive amounts of IP that they can just relentlessly squeeze for value. That was not the Disney of the late 80s and 90s.
Listen, not at
the Disney
all.
Of the late 80s and 90s.
Its live action was tanking.
Yeah.
And its animation was flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reverse today. It's,
its
animation department is really not turning out the hits that it was, whereas its live action is making billions of dollars.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, not making the billions that it was, you know, 5-10 years ago, but it's still turning out hits.
Yep. Sounds very interesting.
This is a phenomenal book. And I mean, if you're interested in these type of exposés, which I am, you will love this book. This book is phenomenal. Like, again, it's an audiobook, but I can't stop listening to it. I absolutely love it.
Very cool. Yeah.
Disney War by James B. Stewart.
Yeah.
So, what book do you have for me this week, Engineer Mike?
Okay, the book I had for you is called, and this is very interesting because I would pronounce it Piranesi.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's actually how it's pronounced. It's one of those words that's clearly either a constructed word or not a word in English. So I just call it Piranesi by the author Susanna Clarke.
Yeah. Piranesi, I believe it's an Italian painter.
Ah, okay. Yeah. All right. So this is a book I kind of just had been seeing mentioned here and there for a few years. I don't think it won any awards. It's the second book by an author called Susanna Clarke, who had a book that some people have probably heard before called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, written about, 20 years ago now. Susanna Clarke has only ever written two books in her life that I know of. I think two novels.
Yeah, basically. I think there was one other book that I saw her.
It was a short collection of short stories, I believe. Okay, yeah. But she wrote a book called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell about 20 years ago that won the Hugo Award that year. It is a, not to talk too much about one of her other books, but it kind of sets up the world of Piranesi. It's a huge book, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Huge, thick book, a rich, rich world, a dream of a book this book was. Dream as in, just felt like a dream you were experiencing. It was this weird story set in an alternate history, Victorian England, where magic is real. I can't really call what the genre of book is, because it's one of those books where clearly an author is just enjoying writing in this world they've created.
Yeah.
And the actual plot that's happening is kind of second to creating the world. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
There we go. Definitely a trend in some works of fiction now where you have footnotes in a work of fiction making your book seem academic-y, you know?
Okay, so yeah. I put a pin in that.
Sure, okay.
As I like to say, because I want to bring something up.
Sure, and Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was well known for that. It had huge long footnotes that would sometimes be pages all on their own. And it was just a rich, rich, rich book to read. When you get to the end of it, you just felt like, good God, have I journeyed. And then Susanna Clarke doesn't really write another book again for nearly 20 years. And then nearly 20 years later, she comes up with a little book compared to Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, a smaller book.
This one was pretty short.
Yep, called Piranesi, where you're kind of dumped into a world where it is not a world you're familiar with, and it just feels like a dream.
Yeah.
And I love that about it. Perfect book for Nina. Something that's not huge, not unwieldy, and considering Susanna Clarke's first book was this huge, thick, you know, knowledgeable tome, this book is bite size almost. So what'd you think about it?
You are not the first person to recommend this book to me.
Interesting. Okay.
You are, yeah, this book has come up a couple of times, whether it's been on book lists or I think one other person recommended this to me. I can't remember who it was, but said, that I would like this book.
Okay.
To go back and get that pin that I was just talking about, about you were talking about academic work.
Yeah.
This book reminded me a lot of another book that you may have heard of called House of Leaves. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, books that want to seem academic. House of Leaves is a very strangely written book. It's very dense.
Have you read it before?
I have.
Okay. Oh,
it came out when I was in high school. Yeah, I think late 90s, early 2000s. I remember reading it when I was in high school.
Yeah.
It's written like a work of academic text.
Interesting.
It's a novel. This is very hard to explain. It's a novel, but it's written like an academic text written about a documentary film.
Oh, okay.
About a house.
It's like the book equivalent of a found fiction movie?
Found
footage movie. Oh, it's actually more like Cannibal Holocaust.
Not that serious. Yeah. More like if Grey Gardens were weird. You know, the documentary Grey Gardens?
Weirder, you mean?
Well, if Grey Gardens were like Piranesi.
Ah, okay. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Where you're in a weird house.
You're in a weird house. All the rooms have different things going on. There's weird different staircases that go to nowhere and all of that. It's extremely dense. It's hard to read. A lot of it doesn't make any sense. In fact, I probably didn't understand most of it when I was in high school. If I go back and read it now, I'll probably understand it a little bit more.
Yeah, it's like the author's alluding to a lot of stuff.
Yes, but it's written like a piece of academic scholarship.
Yeah. Okay. I might actually like this. I might try to read this.
Sure. It's hit or miss.
Yeah.
A lot of people absolutely love it. Most people really don't like it at all. But it is what it is. And that brings me to Piranesi.
Okay, yeah. So tell me about Piranesi. What do you think?
Can I tell you how far I got? You will be shocked at how far I got.
Okay, how far did you get?
I got 38%, according to my e-reader. Almost 40% through this novel.
Wow, very
62
cool.
out of 162
the book
pages. Yeah, it moves pretty quickly. Yeah.
How far did you get again?
62 out of 162 pages.
Very cool. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So like the first two sections. So part two was the other. I got through part one and part two. Those parts were really long.
Interesting.
Like roughly, you know, on average about 30 pages long. And I got through both of them.
I think it has five parts total, maybe, the book.
I think so. I took copious notes.
Oh, yeah. Very Well, so you must have clicked with this book in some way.
I did. It was actually surprisingly, I don't want to say it was easy to read, but
it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a fairy tale.
Yeah, it's like a,
You're talking about a dream. It's like a fairy tale.
Like a fairy tale, yeah.
I've got so much to say about this
book. Sure, okay, so yeah, say something.
My first observation of this book was it's very wet. Like, the world is so wet.
The world is very wet. That is true. It's a house that this person exists in.
Yeah.
And it's always wet.
But here's the thing is, I really don't think it's a house. The scientist, I know the character, the other calls the main character Piranesi.
The main character is Piranesi.
But at one point, Piranesi says, I don't remember that being my name.
Yeah.
He refers to himself as a scientist. So I'm just going to call him the scientist.
Yeah.
This is how he describes the house. He says, outside the house, there's the sun, the moon, and the stars. I think that's either a metaphor or allegory for the earth. So I think the house is actually the earth. And then he talks about the three levels of the house. You know, the lower halls are the tides, so like the oceans.
Yep, yeah.
That's where the fish, the crustaceans, and the vegetation, you know, the sea vegetation is. The upper halls are the clouds. They give fresh water.
Yep.
So the rains.
Yep, yeah.
And then the middle halls are the domains of birds and man, so, and they're largely uninhabitable. That's why I think this is earth, but not of our time. Like, it's either prehistory or it's some event has happened, like some post-apocalyptic thing.
Interesting. So, but do you think the narrator, when they're talking about it being like a house, do you think they're just using words to describe it in that way and it doesn't actually look in that way?
Well, it's an allegory. So you've heard of the cave metaphor, Plato's cave metaphor?
I've heard of it, but I gotta admit, I've never really understood it.
Okay, so the idea of the cave metaphor is you've got three people who have, they've always been in this cave, like either chained up or locked in this cave. They've never been outside of this cave before. One of them breaks free or one of them happens to venture outside of the cave and they see the world for the first time. And, you know, it's indescribable. Like, so, you know, they see trees, they see water, they see the sky, they see the world, basically what we see right now. And they come back to the cave to tell the other two people about it. They have a hard time describing it, but you know, that's the world to them.
Okay.
So the idea of being in ignorance, being naive, and then finally being exposed to the rest of the world.
The book asks questions like
so,
that. I'm not saying you're wrong, because I cannot say you're wrong. Yeah, that is an interesting way to see it. That is the way the book sets it up, though. It, like you're describing, this character is describing this world using terms that we know. But the way this character
is capitalizing of nouns and random words.
That, but you didn't hate it this time.
It bothered me at first. And like a couple of times throughout while I was reading, I was like, okay, why are these words capitalized? But then I was like, all right, I'm just going to go with it.
But the main character, the narrator, is describing things that they see using words that we know and understand, but the way they're using them just doesn't make sense exactly.
Right, and that's kind of where the cave metaphor comes back in, is like, they don't have the words to describe it.
They have
a limited vocabulary, and what they have to use isn't strong enough.
What Nina is describing is exactly correct. That's the way the world is set up in this book. You're like, okay, I know these words, but by God, the picture this person is painting is just bizarre. This doesn't make sense.
So like there's two things I wanted to talk about specifically with this house. And well, I'm just going to call it the house.
Yeah, the character calls it the house.
The scientist calls it the house. So there's so many statues. Hundreds, maybe thousands of statues.
The house is filled with statues.
Statues. And they range in size from being about, you know, as tall as he is to being gigantic. Like megalophobia, almost gigantic. It's really, really creepy the way it's described.
When they would go up to the next level of the house above, the statues were bigger. It's weird.
So what do you think the statues symbolize? Because I've got a theory.
See, I've read the book before. I've got a hypothesis. I don't want to explain too much, even though I couldn't spoil it exactly. I don't really want to explain that. The way this is being described, okay, these statues are clearly representative of something. There's no reason why there's this many statues in this one place, all of so many different random things.
The way his favorite is the woman holding the beehive.
The character says that my favorite statue is a woman holding a beehive, and there's another statue that is a man fishing, And this statue is a little boy holding a kite. You're like, what the hell do these represent? Because clearly they represent something.
In our world, in our earthly domain, the real world, statues, they represent two things. One, they're deities. Not necessarily like gods, but like people that we revere.
Okay.
Or they're something that we fear.
Interesting thing.
You know, the whole megalophobia thing that I just mentioned. We fear giant things.
Yeah.
But in this world, I think they represent the people that came before. They're part of the population because that's why they're in these random acts of the woman holding the beehive.
It seems like a memory.
It's a memory.
It's a photograph of a memory.
Yeah. I could be wrong. I'm just saying this is what...
There's many questions in this book that you're not exactly right or wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
That's totally fine. The book, even when you get to the end, there's some room left open for interpretation still, which is a good book. I think the author clearly knows what it's supposed to represent, but you know the world through the eyes of Piranesi, and Piranesi only knows what Piranesi knows.
Right. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about, the birds.
The birds, yes, there are birds everywhere in this world, everywhere.
He'll talk about the albatross that he found. That's why he named the, in his journals, he's naming it, this is the year the albatross came. And how he gave the albatross or the albatrosses dry seaweed for their nests. He communicates with the birds, or he thinks the birds are communicating with him, which is one, he could be going crazy. He could be just, this is his way of communicating.
This person doesn't know that birds don't talk.
Right.
That's one thing you haven't mentioned it, but Piranesi doesn't seem to have memory in the same way that we have memory.
Exactly. That's a good segue into the other. At first, there are two living characters in this world. So there's the scientist, Piranesi, and the other. The other is his colleague. They're both scientists. The other is obsessed with, I can't remember how it's put, but basically knowledge, like knowledge of powerful or something like that. But it's basically things like the power of flight, the ability to grow wings and fly, like, you know, stuff that obviously isn't
the occult.
Yeah.
Is what it's called. The other is obsessed with the occult.
To me, that's kind of representational of religion or God or something like that. Later on in one of the sections, the other is trying to do a ritual to get these powers.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. And then Piranesi, he goes off to run an errand for him and he comes back from this errand. I don't want to spoil too much of this. It's interesting what happens. And he comes back from this errand and he's changed. He's like, at first he's supportive of this whole pursuit of this magical knowledge stuff. Afterward, he's like, no, not really. I don't think that we should be doing this.
So Piranesi thinks.
Piranesi thinks. And he goes and he tells the other this. He says, I don't think the house wants us to pursue this knowledge. I really think this is a bad idea. And the other says, this is the third time we've had this conversation. This is the third time you've told me not to do this. And he says, basically, the house is fucking with your memory. The scientist, Piranesi, is floored. He's like, what are you talking about? I don't remember my memories being wiped. No, the house is fucking with you. You're having a bad time with time. You don't remember days. You don't remember date. And this is just proof that you need to get right. Then he says, look, there's actually a third person in this house. And if you run across this person, don't talk to them. They're dangerous, and they're going to get in the pursuit of reason. Reason is very important to us, which is extremely ironic considering the other is in pursuit of, like, fanciful things. Like, exactly. The occult.
I love that you still enjoyed that, because the way I would have described this book, it would have been something that I would have thought Nina would have hated this. It's just too symbolic. It's too up its own ass. But it
actually
doesn't seem
isn't.
Like it feels... No, it doesn't feel like that. Describing it without actually reading it, it could sound like a book so thoroughly up its own ass it can't see the sun. But when
it's
you're
really
reading
not...
it, it does not feel like that.
No, no. The way I'm describing it, like listening to myself describing it, like I'm describing... Let me think of a good comparison real quick.
Comparing it to another book or something?
Comparing it to
another
book.
A book that's up its own ass?
Yeah.
What's a book that's... Think of a book that's up its own ass.
Okay.
You know, we know many.
I'm describing the Satanic Verses.
There we go. Okay, yeah, something like the Satanic Verses. A book up its own ass.
Yeah.
You know, no offense to Salman Rushdie, but the Satanic Verses is so thoroughly up its own ass.
It really is.
Most people never make it past the first 10 pages.
And I read the entire book.
Wow, okay, so you're that person who made it past the first
did.
Campaign. Did you like it?
No.
Oh, okay. You read the entire book?
I read the entire
like.
Book in high school. Describing this book, it sounds like I'm trying to describe the Satanic Verses.
But it's not like that.
It's not like that at all.
No,
it's more
no.
like a like almost like a fairy tale.
It's like a fairy tale. It's written with such care and love.
Yeah.
This book. This writer, Susanna Clarke, loved whatever she was writing here. Loved writing this book.
Yeah.
You can tell. You can feel it. Very nice. Very cool. So first question is, I kind of want to ask the second question first, is would you continue reading?
I think I
read 40% already.
I mean, I think I will.
Please do. If you like what you read, it's just more of that.
Yeah.
And it has a very cool progression of events. Yeah. A plot, I think it's called.
It is. That is called a plot.
I'm not a writer. I don't know this stuff. I just read. So, do you think the first chapter works?
Okay.
Yeah, see, that's interesting, because you had that 40% of it. Yeah.
That is an interesting question, and I'm glad you saved that for last.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I will read more. I don't think it works as a first chapter, though.
I think maybe you stumbled upon the fact that it's so fun to read, nobody stops at the first chapter.
Yeah. I think if you just gave someone that first chapter...
Yeah. They'd be like, what the fuck is all this? What the hell is going on?
I think... I think for this, your mileage may vary.
Ah, interesting. Yeah.
I don't know if it works as a first chapter. I think this is something you've really got to sit down and consume. Okay. But I might read all, I've got, you know, like three other books I'm juggling right now.
Sure.
I think I have to read all of this
Please
today.
Please do. As you said, you read 40% of it now. You could finish it up
And the
quickly.
Thing is, this is a short book.
Yes.
It's 167 or 162 pages. It's so short. Yeah, you could sit down and read this like...
In an evening?
In an evening.
That's why I said it's so interesting that this is by an author... whose only other book is like 1,000 pages thick.
Yeah.
It's like almost the author was like, I don't need to write another book that thick. Let's write a quick snackable novel. Yeah.
My last book was 800 pages, so I am such a fucking hypocrite when I say this, but let's hear it for short books.
I agree. Please write something like this again. Yeah.
Right. I need to write something as short as a bitter spring again.
Think of like a real good story. Doesn't have to be long. Don't go into deep and just kind of write it up.
I think my next book or the book I'm writing right now it's going to have to be broken up in the first part.
Yes,
the first
do.
Book
yeah,
is.
Yeah, just write it out. I mean, that's the only advice I could give as a non-writer is just I do know how creativity works. When you feel that creativity bug biting as an author, don't stop. Don't get in the way of it. Just write it out. Don't even think about it too much. One of the best novels I ever read in my life is called The Running Man by Stephen King. He apparently, as by his own account and by probably his publisher's account, he wrote the whole damn thing in one cocaine-fueled weekend.
I was about to say, what Stephen King had that I don't? Is
lots of coke.
Yes.
I know, but you don't need it. You don't need that because you have raw talent.
I also need...
You have raw, uncut, Detroit-made talent. But yeah, no, exactly. Let's hear it for short fucking books. Like I notice in the movie world right now, you're kind of starting to see some short movies again, thankfully. Yeah. And I mean short as in normal length for most of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, an hour and a half. Let's hear it for some short books.
Yeah.
167 pages. Great story. You pick it up. You don't want to put it down. That's a good book, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That's a great book.
I agree.
As much as I love reading through a 1,000-page tome that's wonderful, I would love to read in that same time period like 4 books like Piranesi.
Yeah.
I really, really would.
Yeah.
Thank you for liking that. That's an interesting one we had where you didn't think the first chapter necessarily worked, but the book definitely seems like it does.
I got some good momentum. I think I'm going to finish it tonight.
Hey, very cool. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Every now and then, 1 out of every 5 books, I kind of stumble upon one where I'm like, I think Nina actually might like this one. I'm only got about a 20% hit rate.
You don't.
But that 20% is really great. I'm like that one baseball player you've got on your team who he's going to miss 4 out of every 5 balls that are thrown at him. But that one pitch that he gets, it's a home run every single time.
I don't understand baseball, but I would not have that player on my team. But
no, you should have. Well, no. Most likely you wouldn't want to have that player on the team. But you know what? The crowds love him. That's me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Crowds do love him.
There we go. I may not be the best on paper, but every now and then a crowd loves me.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. Keep reading.
Keep reading.
Thanks for listening to First Chapters, a podcast from Grey Cat Books. Your hosts were Nina McNamara and Engineer Mike. Our music was provided by Alex Productions and Virtua Jams. Check out our website at greycatbooks.com for links to our credits. Thanks again for listening.